Recording.
All right, good.
Good to see everybody tonight. We're continuing along with our study in Bava Batra, and going to be a little bit outside the text before we get into the text. We're going to go outside to go inside, I guess, like we say sometimes. So last week when we were learning in Bava Batra, today we're going to be going back to a story that follows the stories of the sages, kind of seeing themselves as maybe a class apart or a certain status under the law vis-a-vis taxation and vis-a-vis any kind of requirement to participate in great tzedakah endeavors. And remember we said that we're using the word tzedakah kind of interchangeably with taxation at this point, because we're talking about obligations on the communal level for that which is deemed an important public work for safety, and a safety net for things like feeding hungry people. And we made the point that the rabbis are moving us in terms of from Torah to rabbinic culture, from the notion of individuals' responsibilities in their agricultural realities in Torah to dealing with the new physical reality on the ground, and that is the sense that you live in a polis. You live in a city. And there's not only an individual obligation that's going to fall on people following rabbinic law, but that there's an obligation on a policy level and on a communal level to create policy that ultimately deals with what is becoming the recognition of a certain class of people, and that class of people, if you will, or that group of people, is the poor, which we said was not necessarily recognized in that period as a group in the ancient law codes. The poor qua the poor. Nice to see you.
Hey.
Welcome back to the Beit Midrash. Yeah, you'll have to move the papers a little bit and take your spot, Carol. This is good. Good reason to move papers, shuffle papers. So the beginnings of any kind of policy about tzedakah and about taxation that is more along the lines of required funding for public works and to create the public safety net is all developing in front of us on these pages of Gemara. And the records of the conversations about what informs our policy is as important, those records are as important as what the policies are themselves. We have to read the Gemara as being kind of records, minutes of the meetings. You know, I was just at a talk at Cardozo Law School this past week. Great talk about a book called Fighting Evil by Professor Jim Waller. That book is about policy making, anti-genocide policy making. And before there was ever such a word as genocide and a genocide convention, people had to deal with what would be in the genocide convention. How shall we define it? Under the law, what is the law of the crime of genocide? How shall we create some type of legal parameters for individual states take on what we see as genocide, either genocidal processes in motion, actual genocide happening? Is this only a convention about responding to genocide with the use of force? Are there ways for other international bodies, organizations, states to accuse other states of genocide? Who are the players that are responsible to actually police this, to enforce the law, to bring resources to bear? And I'm telling you all this because what he did in his book is he did not concentrate on the Genocide Convention itself that was passed at the UN, what he concentrated on was reading the minutes of every committee deliberation before the convention was actually created, so that he could see what was included in the convention itself. and what was not included in the convention, and what the ideas were recorded by very, very important secretaries and editors of the minutes, in order to understand the thinking behind why it was, in his view, very much narrowed, and the law was narrowed in a certain way, not as comprehensive as, let's say, the founder of the one who coined the terms, Raphael Lemkin, not as expansive as Lemkin saw it in the world of what this potential crime holds, what responses we might have to it, and for sure today, in today's world, since we have identified processes of genocidal action, how it does not respond to certain kind of needs that we see within societies where it's unfolding, happening beforehand. And his commentary and conclusions both visit the minutes of the meetings that said, look, people understood that if you're saving people from the river midstream, and you save another person from the river midstream, and you put them on the shore, and then you swim back into the river, and you're fighting the current, and you take them out midstream, and you're fighting it again, and you're getting so tired that you ought to move upstream, right? See what the problem is, why all these people are floating down the river and need to be saved in the first place, and take care of some of the problems up here, and maybe the reinterpretation, reinvention of law and policy regarding that genocide prevention, genocide as a crime, needs to happen within the greater context of the international bodies that deal with this. Same, we could say, in some way, about the Talmud in certain places, a sugya, our pages, say page 7 to page 11 in Bava Metzia, are in many ways, yes, rabbinic policy here and there implemented for the moment within a given polis, but they're also like having the minutes of the meetings to say, we know that there's now an unfolding reality in front of us. We're organizing ourselves living in urban centers, mini urban centers, the polis in terms of the ancient world. We know that this is a real change in agricultural, leaving your fields corners and giving tzedakah that way. How do we really create the system that's going to work for all of us? How do we do it within our own community in terms of the poor among us? Are we willing to see them as a group of citizens, the poor? Do we respond to them? How do we deal with the outside authority who's given us like the charter to have our own little polis when they want to tax us and they want to have a head tax, and who's in and who's outside of that, and who can they ask for a tax within? Because that's part of the justice, the righteous, seeking righteousness, tzedakah as the justice word. Who are we going to allow to pay that tax? Who are we not? So I remind you again of that greater framework of these pages and these sugyot, because the stories within them sometimes seem like, boy, they're abrogating their responsibilities when they're saying, I don't have to pay the tax, and the rabbis who live around here don't have to pay the same tax, don't have to participate in the same tzedakah program as the commoners over there. But what they're doing is, in a certain way, dealing with the realities of who has money, who doesn't have money, how do we deal with this class of people who may have a little bit more, how do we deal with this people who have a status of being orphans, how do we ourselves continue to create the kind of centers of policy discussion and learning that we want, and how do we live economically among our brethren in order to really be the leaders here, and should we afford ourselves special status in that way, because it is internal, vis-a-vis tzedakah and vis-a-vis the taxation issue. We're going to see a story soon in the Gemara tonight. We're going to start with a story that we need to unpack, that might seem at first like we want to react like, how could he say that? How could he limit the tzedakah that he's willing to do and willing to give like that? Those questions are going to come up for us when we come back to page 8a. But we're not going to start with page 8a. We're going to get into Gemara in a minute, because we're going to be, like I said, outside the Gemara for a minute on pages 14 and 15, the handouts I gave you. And as a matter of fact, I think I gave mine away. So I think I need 14 and 15 over there. Thank you. I wanted to just point out, and I did this because of two reasons. One, I wanted to show you some of the sources, again, from that move from agriculture and Torah to tzedakah, the polis, the rabbinic notion of thinking about wealth and income and how we must distribute. And also this week's parsha, Vayetze, which Meir and I were just discussing, is the first time that we have the notion of separating out a tenth. In the words, Asar Asarenu, I will separate out a tenth from all that I've been blessed with. Okay, so starting though on 14, we go to Deuteronomy first, where the notion of a tithe is highlighted. I'm on page 14 of the sources, source number one there. And so you have Devarim in 14:22, take a second tithe of all the seed crops that come forth in the field each year. So that is referring to, as it says here, Maaser Sheni, the second tithe, which was given variably to the Levites or to the poor in general. While the plain meaning of the verse only includes produce in the tithing obligation, its wording is interpreted as including other things. Well, it was definitely agricultural when you needed it to be only agricultural, and interpreted to include other things when you start to move into a societal reality where other things are really important. So the Tosafot on Ta'anit 9a, Asar Ta'aser, regarding the tithe, Hachi Ita B'Sifri, here is what it says in interpreting the verse, Asar Ta'aser, Et Kol Tevua Zarecha Hayotzei HaSadei Shana Shana, that you should have a tenth of this produce go to either the poor or the Levites, depending on the year, Ein Li Eila Tevua Zarecha Shechaya B'Masar. That is only the tithe seed crops. Ribiru frachmatia v'chol shar vachim minayin. But from where do we know that one is obligated to tithe interest collected, businesses, and all other profits? What's surprising about that, by the way?
Interest.
Interest.
Yeah, interest.
Right? We're talking about interest to non-Jews here, of course. Talmud Lomar, that is to say, here's where we learn it from. We learn that you have to take a tithe for these other profits. The Havamati Lomar et Tevuatcha. From the extra word in the verse, all, Michael. Why do we have the word all in the verse and not just the seed crops? Kol l'rabot ribid ufrakmati v'chol davar shemar v'yachbo. That is because we use the one word kol in halachic terminology and halachic reasoning to make a what's called ribui. We expand our understanding of what has to be tithed by finding in the word kol, which seems like lashon yetera, extra language in our verse, the ability to actually say anything that you're profiting by requires a tithe. And it is a tenth part.
So they say shana shana, so it's every year. What about shnat shemitah?
Well, it is a little bit of a different system then.
And there is a difference between shnat agriculture and business, like environment. Because
yeah. Those are technicalities of the system, and if we were learning through all of the different laws of the year to year, we would see that they're very distinct. But I'd like to.
But it does in the Torah talk about Shnat HaShemitah.
Of course.
From Re'eh.
Yeah.
And it does later talk about
right.
The Shnat HaShemitah.
And you're gonna get the way that happens. You're gonna leave everything. People can come eat it.
Yeah, Shnat HaShemitah is free for all.
Pretty much. Okay, look at the next piece, though. So the Chafetz Chaim is from, you know, not so long ago. Down on the bottom, number three. Right? Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan. And we have so much of his commentary, the Chafetz Chaim, on Lashon Hara, let's say. People know him generally as someone who wrote a lot about the notion of speaking ill of others, gossip. That's what he's really well known for. Chafetz Chaim Yeshiva was very centered on the notion of creating menches like that and not speaking Lashon Hara. But he also wrote a lot about halacha, just the generally way of Jewish living under Jewish law. Very important figure. I forget his years exactly. Let's see if we can find his years. The Chafetz Chaim. The famous story of the Chafetz Chaim parallels that of Rabbi Meir, where they're in court, and the Chafetz Chaim is at one point almost going to be the accuser of this guy who stole so much from him, and they're waiting there in the courtroom, and he's not shown up, and they say, what's with the rabbi? What's with the Chafetz Chaim? And the Chafetz Chaim said, the representative said, the Rav just decided to make everything hefker. He just decided to disown everything 5 minutes before the guy stole everything, so that really the guy didn't steal a single thing from him. He doesn't want to, you know, have him go through any kind of court process here and serve a sentence that's any harsher than what he would have gotten normally, because everybody wants to really get this guy, and he stole from the rabbi, and this is terrible. So he just gave up his entire, you know, body of possessions that the guy stole. And come on. Really, is that this rabbi? And everybody's looking around. You know, this rabbi. How could he be like that? Really, could he be like that? Really give it up like that? And one of the guys pipes up and he says in the courtroom, I don't know if that's exactly what happened. And I can't. We hear this every other week about this rabbi. But they're for sure not telling stories about you and me like that. So that's the way the story ends. Yeah, that's the famous story of the Chafetz Chaim. So the Chafetz Chaim, Rabbi Israel Meir Kagan, was born 1839 and died in 1933. So he said, and he has a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, the major code of Jewish law. Tov sheyargil et atzmo lahafrish maaser mikol ma sheyazmin lo Hashem ruach binyanav, revach binyanav. It's good to accustom oneself to separate a tenth of all profit with which God provides him. So anything you get, you have a profit, set aside a tenth. V'gad ramaser hu d'tzarich lahafrish mitchila maser min hakeren v'achar kach k'sheyazmin lo Hashem yibarach revach yitein maser min harevach. One should first give a tenth of the capital, and subsequently, when he makes profit, to separate a tenth of all the profit he makes. It's a tall order. Really tall order?
That's a little bit big contribution. Every year, after 10 years, you have nothing.
Achar nichui ha-hotza'ot me'ha'esek.
Before or after taxes?
It's definitely, though, after deducting his business expenses. So, you know, what could you do? For sure, Carol, you could say, look at how expensive it was to run my business. Right? Taxes, like we said about government taxes, they're not exactly relating to taxes societally all the time. And the question does become whether or not I can count my taxes into my tzedakah in a lot of cases. The Rambam, in the 11th, you know, back when he wrote, will say that spending money for your children on education is afforded as tzedakah. So already, like, some people say, okay, I can't really, quote-unquote, deduct that on my taxes in America, but if I'm paying for day school education, and I count that towards my own tzedakah, and then I just gave like $2,000 more on my tax return, but people don't see that I was that generous, because really it added up to, who knows what, 15% with all the money I paid for education. Here, is that legitimate? In Jewish terms, it's legitimate. A little different than your question. But after business expenses, at least. So you can definitely kind of see room to wiggle here. But the question is, I mean, I don't know if you'd be completely depleted of all of your funding if you really held to a tenth. But a
tenth of the principal.
Right.
And expenses you take from profits. So it's not very quick, maybe 11 years.
It's not clear if this is an income tax or a wealth tax. Those are two very different issues. And this seems to be, because the next on the next page, the first sentence implies it's a wealth tax, but the way it's written here, it looks like it's an income tax.
Right. So if you really think about what this is saying in terms of Masek Safim, that you have a certain kind of profit that you made and therefore you ought to give charity, that's probably the best way to see this.
That's an income tax. But a wealth tax, which is what's said in the next page, is a totally different beast.
Yeah, and it is a little bit different. And that's why there's a little bit of what sounds confusing based on the fact that we experience taxation in these kinds of different ways. If you go into a pure tzedakah orientation, right, what is this really saying about the money you have in your pocket? Plainly, that you got to give a tenth. Just plainly.
Well, if we go back to the agricultural world, presumably all wealth was land.
And crops.
Well, I'm just saying.
Land, yeah, so, land and produce of land.
So then in that setting, of course, you're the gleaning and the tithing of that. So that's somewhere between a wealth tax and an income tax for that year, because obviously it all depends upon the year. But the issue of not wanting the accumulation of wealth separate from the income in any given year is a very different concept.
Yeah, I don't think they're suggesting that you have to give up 10% of your land.
Right.
By way of the agricultural
right.
Notion.
No, but in business, you're saying that the concept, with Shemitah, you're going to wind up giving back land, right?
For you.
If you wind up owning other people's land because they were indebted to you, at Shemitah, you're going to wind up giving them back that, right? You're going to give that back to them, right?
Well, at least at Yovel.
Right, the Jubilee. So
there is some sense of wealth redistribution at the Yovel in the Torah, and that gets into how definitive is that return. You know, are there ways like the Prose Bowl? Remember, Hillel instituted this whole thing. I might not lend a friend money
in the sixth year
if I know that I've got to
never get it back.
You know, I've got to basically remit the debt in the year seven, right? So he creates the Prose Bowl, which is that the loan is held by the Beit Din, and that you really still owe the person money. And okay, so that's just a continuation of creating systems whereby we don't necessarily tell people that they have to quote unquote lose their shirt, that they don't have to hold on to their wealth. We don't tell them that you have to give up significant amounts of wealth and significant amounts to claim for people to return money you've loaned or land. And systems exist like that so that people can hold on to their land and people can hold on to their paper. In other words, the loan that's due. Because it comes from Tevuah, the notion here really, we could say, if we wanted to just beat down on it, if you have, you know, a great yield, the idea is either for the Levites or for the poor, you're giving 10% of that, right? In the charitable giving case of this halacha here from Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, it seems as though he's suggesting that if you own a business that's worth $1 million, right? So think about putting 10% into a foundation. And then, over time, as Ron said, perhaps you would have a reduction in the value, in the net value of that business. Except that he's imagining you're going to profit, even at the same time that you're, quote-unquote, giving that amount towards the foundation that gives away money. And the question is whether or not you can really live in that kind of numbers game, or you have to draw back. Because maybe that number is simply aspirational. And this has been a question in Jewish circles. How much could I really put into my foundation? Like, for instance, I'll give you one CEO of a multinational with whom I spoke about his tzedakah practice. He's a Jewish guy, very serious about his creation of a foundation within the corporation. He feels that he can only really do 2% of net worth and company earnings, and that the board is much more comfortable with 2% of net earnings after tax, and not 2% of net worth of company.
We're back to the difference between an income tax and a wealth tax.
Exactly. And so you do have this discussion very much so on the page right here in front of us. And then so the question becomes about a halakha like this, about a Jewish law like this, then what is it? Is it simply a totally creative aspiration for what it could mean in a society based on a Torah principle that you were giving 10% of your tevuah, of your seed-bearing plant? Or when this comes along and says, hey, there's an ideal here, perhaps there will be a way for you to really work this through, that you really are working on it, and it helps you get, who knows, incrementally more generous throughout your business life, if you're a company owner and you decide along with the, whether it's with the employees or not, and there's all kinds of discussions about that too, that is it only your decision, or is it your decision along with the employees who made the profits? These are all interesting discussions in modern, quote-unquote, tzedakah circles when it comes to applying these laws. So it is a big question about how these get applied. Reading the next one, since Barry mentioned it, let's just turn the page to number 4. Those who give a tenth or fifth from all of their profits are much greater than those who just give tzedakah, even if they give the same amount. The reason being that those who just give tzedakah only have the mitzvah of tzedakah, with their business being no different than any other business. So if it's a matter of taking from your own personal income and giving tzedakah, of course, you're a tzadkan.
Thank you.
But if you set up your business in such a way that your business also has a quote-unquote tzedakah branch, then you have the mitzvah of tzedakah and the mitzvah of maser. So really, this halacha is figuring on the fact that you yourself will be a baal tzedakah. You will take care of your tzedakah obligations and requirements. But if you own a business, then gets into this whole question that we brought up once before in the midst of our discussions about these pages we're learning now. CSR, we've called it, corporate social responsibility, or foundation work, or charity through corporate endeavor. Is that an obligation? And especially if I'm a Jewish business owner, is that my obligation? This guy who I talked to you about just now, the foundation, 2%er, really thought that the maser could be expressed through 2%, at least of net profits, in his business, and he thought that he was fulfilling this maser component, and he still, at the same time, as an individual, feels very strongly and takes very seriously the mitzvah of tzedakah and tries to really figure it out from his own personal income as a separate venture. And that's what I think the force of this next piece was saying.
I came in late, so maybe you discussed this, but there are some companies that, charitably underwrite certain things, but they also get a lot of credit for it. Is it still tzedakah if you're getting deductions and credit and all kinds of tax things if you're doing that?
That's a wash.
That's an interesting question. I mean, that's a perfect question for this moment, because that is the question. If I set up the foundation and I'm putting 2% of my profit in, or let's say up to 10%, doesn't want you to go broke, Jewish law. Doesn't say until you feel comfortable. So, but let's say 2%. Write it in as a deduction. You get the credits for it. Even if you get a credit for a third, or two-thirds, depending on the given year. I understand those things have changed over time. I don't own such a corporation where I have a foundation, so I don't know what the credit is these days. Is it fair to deduct that? Is it a mitzvah if I deduct that? Fair under the law, using the law in America, I would say it's fair.
The rules of
right. If I was doing my taxes as someone who believes in tzedakah, the question is like this. Should I, do I have an obligation when I give to give the full 100% of my tzedakah up to the tenth that the Gemara might suggest and not, what do you call it, deduct anything on my taxes?
Not claim any benefit.
Not claim any benefit.
Would I have an issue with the example you gave about the day school? Because he's getting a value for that. His kid's getting an education. So that tuition can't be
invested in his future.
Well, you're very taken with American law, Arthur, which you should be. I mean, you're a member of the bar.
Sorry.
Under Jewish law, the guy can claim that kind of the value piece and this tax policy that we have in America is really not the way that Jewish law sees my investment in creating agency for education for my child. Because you know what? You know why? Because I'm ultimately responsible for educating my child, but when I can't do it, and I have to hire shlichim, I have to hire agents, then I should pay them for the potential work they could otherwise be doing. But since they're doing education and not other work, I have to give them, like, gifts. And it's actually, like, gifts. So when you pay an educator or a rabbi in Jewish circles, the question is, are you paying them an income, or are you giving them a gift for... Otherwise, they would be at work doing the same thing you might be doing.
If you declare it as an expense, it's an income.
Okay, so there are lots of technicalities here, but the bigger, the ethical question really is, on a personal ethical basis, meaning a personal mitzvah basis, do you feel comfortable writing in to the taxes, to those forms, taking deductions for that which "quote unquote" represents tzedakah that we give.
You can make a very simple argument that if you don't take the deduction, the next year you'll have less money for tzedakah. So
you're right.
There's a lot of circularity to it, and you know I don't think so. The issue of benefit depends on what you're planning to do with your money at the end, really. You know, if where it's going ultimately.
Some people,
well, that's a nice,
you know.
No, but that's not just circularity, but that's a values orientation, right? So if my values orientation is to have as much money as possible, not only for my family, but for my charitable contributions at the end of the day, and I know that there's a legal system in America that lets me both do my mitzvah and retain a certain amount of that money for future, both good, enjoyable family life and fulfilling my obligation as a Jewish person vis-a-vis my mitzvah of tzedakah, I could see that as being a way to say, okay, so I'll use the system. Just like sometimes, right, here's the thing, like the daily dapim of the Talmud that we're learning now, Jews, we said before, they can't charge interest, right? Ah, but what if I want to borrow some money from you to start a business?
Well, you can give a heder esker and you're okay.
What's that?
You can give a heder esker and you're okay.
So you give a certain permission to use the money for business, and you use that money for business to make a profit, and then what happens? So you don't charge me interest, but you say...
I make you a partnership.
I make you a partner, kind of. And yeah. And when the profit comes in, I give you back the 10% on the money. You get the first 50% of the profit.
It's a loan.
Is that system necessarily a corrupt system? Is it a loophole? We've talked about this before. Or is it a distinction for the way we ultimately create a values orientation? The value is that we do want people to loan money, and we do want them not to feel like they won't make money giving to their own neighbor in the Jewish and among Jewish brethren. And so we have to come up with a system that works for us.
Well, alternatively, you can give more so that even with the deduction, you end up with 2%. That has been given. So I don't know in terms of percentages, but if you end up giving more and then after your deduction, let's say you get 5% or 4%, and then you will end up with a
Yeah, net. You can do that, but you cannot do it from your principal. You can do it only from the profit, because if you will do it from the principal, a year by year, you reduce your...
Right.
Right, so that's the surprising part, right? that there's a certain kind of sense, if this is about the real principle behind all of the wealth that's building, that's really the different kind of economic policy than simply the tax on the yield or the profits that comes in through the door.
Yeah, because that eats its potential for future.
Exactly.
But not if you can deduct the tax on the principal from the profits that you're paying tax on the income.
Yeah, it could be. And that could be a good reason why we've...
Or it could just be a system to allow mixed motives.
Right, but that's also why we've also said Dina de Malchut de Dina, the law of the land is the law, and we've not just had our own little insisting on our own system of taxation that includes a drawing down principle, right?
Do you know what
you
When I was, have you talked about, I mean, you know, I haven't been here the whole season, so I'm sorry, but have you talked about the distinction between corporations, which you alluded to, corporations which have their foundations, which are really, you know, mostly hypocritical PR machines, which are in many cases directly opposite their business motive. Yeah. You know,
their politics.
Clean, shiny.
I'm shocked. Yeah.
Shine
their politics.
So I mean, have you gone into that? Have you done a whole
separate? Not as much, not as let's say, not with all that swinging.
Because that's a big, you know, that's such a huge part of, you know, so-called tzedakah today, which is so corrupt on a certain level.
I wouldn't necessarily
say that. Self-serving.
I would.
I mean, we haven't really, we've only scratched the surface because we're talking about individuals and institutions. The rabbis took themselves, what we did say is the rabbis took themselves out of kind of paying into tzedakah projects for some reason or another. We're kind of investigating that within the pages that we're learning right now. And that is an open question for me. Why the rabbis, even in the minutes of these discussions about collective taxation responsibility, public works investments, tzedakah for the poor, why it seems like sometimes they're out of it, maybe because A, they don't want to be hypocritical at any given moment, maybe two, they don't have the money themselves, they're impoverished, but their corporation seems not to be involved in that same way. When corporations do get involved, what we have said is that the question is, are they acting like private citizens or not? Should there be same standards, different standards? And is this a real possibility that those standards would ever be taken seriously as really being charitable, or is it only for PR? Is the question you're asking now, and it's a good question because, you know, are people seeing the poor and those in need as the individuals who they are, or are they simply trending with charitable giving and just kind of creating that image that sells? What I brought up last time, Dr. Rabbi Aryeh Cohen's work in terms of writing about the ethics of charity, tzedakah, from within these pages, he is suggesting that there is space for both government officials and for corporate officials who are players in the society, the polis today, to learn how to be more what he is going to call Levinasian, right? Levinas, the great French thinker, who says, I can see the other. I will see the other. My policies in my foundation, our policies in taxation, will ultimately recognize the other if we only learn to seek justice. He believes the Talmud is introducing that idea and continues to introduce that idea into dialogue about how to be a corporate citizen, dialogue how to be a personal citizen. He's only hoping that that message is taken seriously. So too with CSR courses in business schools right now, where they think they're teaching a little bit about that purity of spirit and citizenship, while at the same time, it's really tough for boardrooms to really pass great charitable policy, right? It is really tough.
Won't you say, though, that we're talking about all of this in terms of the corporation and what they benefit from, but the biggest benefit is the money that's given to the poor.
But
the point of what we're talking about is that okay, so he may take it off on his taxes. He may get some PR out of it. It's still money that's theoretically being well spent. And that's and poor, like if you're a poor person, you need food. Do you care whether some corporation is getting a PR benefit from the fact that they're feeding you? No. You're happy that you're getting the food.
You're reminding me of a great story. So I don't know who was here to hear him, but Stephen Grimaldi was here from the New York Comic Pantry, right?
Yeah.
And he's a friend, and we're associated. It was a Tuesday or Wednesday. I wound up on a van with 11 other people, and we drove past all these neighborhoods I'd never experienced before, up into the Red Hook area. Is it Red Hook in the Bronx?
No, it's Brooklyn.
That's Brooklyn.
Yeah.
So what's the area that's all the warehouses?
Mott Haven?
South Bronx?
It's not South Bronx. Anyway, it's out in Yenemsveld in the Bronx.
Well, the market.
Yeah.
They moved the
Hunt's
market.
Hunt's Point.
That's it.
Yeah,
that's
the
it.
Fish market.
Not Red Hook. Hunt's Point. It's a warehouse full of government food for the what was called food stamps before. There's all kinds of possibilities for supplementing that. We go back to the office. There's a nutrition specialist. She's teaching people how to make local gardens and spaces, and then taking donations from all kinds of places and trying to get more people to donate, like City Harvest does. Mm-hmm. New York Comic Pantry is also getting a lot of that now. And and I met a person in the new satellite office, and I said, oh, right here next to this government box of cheese food.
Cheese products.
was real cheese. And I said, oh boy, you want the government one or this other one? I was kibitzing. He said, I don't care who gives me the cheese as long as I can take both. You know, so you're on to something. And recognizing that in the human being there, it is one part of the depth of what we need to say. Like, okay, they should have something in their hand today. How are we going to deliver that? But on the whole, if we're interested in societal systems of justice, core systems of tzedakah, then I think it's at the same time important for us to reflect on how indeed we are teaching business leaders, we are expecting our leadership, we are, as a Jewish community, setting into UJA policy the distribution. And what we kind of signal out. And so there is an obligation for us to ask what are our motivations, because that ultimately that's what your question gets to, the motivations behind this. The rabbis, I think, would argue for kavanah being purposeful, being a very meaningful kind of concept. The intentionality goes along with this, and who knows what grows from that. I can't tell you I know exactly what grows from that, but I think they would ask us to at least consider it.
It reminds me of the story when Rabbi Wexler was here. He asked, which is more praiseworthy, a poor person donating $10 or a rich person donating $100? And he said, the rich person, because the recipient is getting $100. This is what matters. So, intentionality, understand, but
it's
another way.
It's not
that. It's the recipients. Really.
Yeah, I want both.
I don't see what's wrong with the PR, because it's like when Sharon and I donated, now me alone, I want to emulate other people who've made donations. Otherwise, I wouldn't do it. I mean, they're role models.
It's not,
advertising, you do this. How do you learn that you're supposed to do it?
We know that people give for all kinds of different motivations. That's why there are lists of these things, right? Here are the 8 ways people give, some anonymously, and some because their friend told them, come do this, and some because I have to show myself as having decency in the world.
And in fact,
yeah, but the car is given beseter. Our concept is,
again, some is and some isn't.
And today,
and there are lists, Ron, and we pointed this out, and it's very important for me to continue to point out, giving secretly and anonymously does not lead all the time, the way the rabbis see it, to others being inspired to give and to people making loans when it's necessary.
But it's a mitzvah. So
it's a mitzvah.
Jewish community,
It's a mitzvah that you can do in many ways. Giving can be done in many ways. Anonymously is only one way, and all those who rank ways of giving may hold that in higher esteem than some other ways, but it's not the highest. And named giving in synagogues, in halachic literature, is a historical reality all the way back from ancient Bate Knesset, where we see names on the wall, to this very day, right? So there's a great tradition of naming and gift-giving with naming.
Naming and is a transaction.
Whatever it is it gives inspiration to others, as Charlie's suggesting. So anonymity is only one option.
The car is something that you don't get reward for, except reward from God.
Not really.
And if you have a transaction, then you bought your name. You put your name. It's a deal.
It's not so clear. Yeah.
Have you ever been to UJA Lawyers Division Dinner? Or Wall Street Division Dinner?
Yeah. Not anonymous. So, yeah. You know, I just want to say it's a great concern because there are suggestions that they're going to take away the benefits, the financial, you know, tax benefits for giving charity in this country. And we know that in other countries in Europe, they do not give tax credits, and they do not get a lot of charity. There is not a lot of giving in all of realms. I mean, the government has to subsidize the arts and all kinds of things because private people
but
are not doing it.
Taxation is higher in Europe.
What?
Because of this taxation in Europe is much higher than in the United States. So and they get more benefits.
So not necessarily so.
Well, I'm not an expert on that, but I do think that, you know, the level of giving, if you don't have some kind of financial write-off for it, is going to plummet completely. So it's very important.
Well, in terms of our tradition, I wanted to point out the next verse is our verse from this week's Parsha, Asera Astrenu, that Yaakov is the one who says, I realize that all I'm going to gain in my life, I really do have to tithe, and I'm going to give a tenth part, Jacob. So it is in the realm of ancestry of Avod Imahot, that time of our great-great-great ancestors. I'm on now source 1 on page 15, if you're looking for the verse I'm referencing. That he does say, I will give back. And on Yaakov's wording, there are even those who say you're going to give a tenth twice. But again,
his is conditional.
Yeah.
He says, only if you fulfill your half.
And that's how some people then say about Yaakov's, like, oh, wait a minute. He's saying, if you do this for me, then I'll give
totally
it.
Totally conditional commitment.
And there's another way of looking at that maybe I'm going to talk about on Shabbos. So I'm going to hold off so we can get into the Gemara story that I want to now start reading with you. Let's go. 8a2. So turn in the now packet of Gemara material to 8a2. It's 8b, so if you have the Vilna Shas and you want to be in the...
Do you have any more English versions?
Any more English versions?
You want some David Knight.
It's a good problem to have. You all came in such bountiful... here, over here. Aria needs it.
Yeah.
There you go. Thank you for sharing. Okay, so 8a2. Now, I said we're going to have to unpack this story, and I want to unpack this story with you and see what meaning we can make of it. We're going to ask ourselves why exactly Rebbe holds the position he holds vis-a-vis tzedakah. And as I said, I again, remind us of the framework. Some of these are discussions that happened, if you will, in the committee meetings. How are we going to create the right kind of policies for relieving hunger? How are we going to create those policies? So I'm on the second column where it says the Gemara relates an incident. Rabbi patach otzarot bishnei batzoret. Rabbi, who is Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the preeminent sage who edits the Mishnah, and I believe is used here because of his preeminence, and you have to understand how important a figure he is to the sages and the rabbi's cultural realm. So he opened the storehouses of food or grain, mostly all kinds of food probably, to feed the poor during the years of famine, or to feed some poor, it might say. Amar, he said the following, Yikansu Bale Mikra, Bale Mishnah, Bale Gemara, Bale Halacha, Bale Haggadah. He said, only those students who are students who know scripture, and students of Mishnah, and students of Gemara, or students and students of Halacha, and of the homiletic literature of Haggadah, may enter and take food from the storehouse. So these are years of famine, and he seemingly limits the distribution. Aval ame'aretz lo yikansu, and unlearned folks may not enter to take any of the food. Now, read generously, people like the Ritva and some of the Rishonim say, well, he's very concerned. Maybe he doesn't have enough. There are others who don't, quote-unquote, limit it in that sense. That it's a bigger question here. Is he limiting in a real way and only giving food to those in his, quote-unquote, family first? In the rabbinic circle. Dach, Rabbi Yonatan ben Amram v'nichnas. Rabbi Yonatan ben Amram, a disciple of Rebbe, he disguises himself. And he pushes his way into the storehouse. Now, what's interesting here is as follows. The verb dahak,
pushed himself,
is the verb that gives away already that he's fighting for his way in. Mm-hmm. The story will reveal that really he is disguised and that nobody really knows who he is. He becomes anonymous somehow. Now, if he's a disciple and if he's, you know, someone who you know, this is a colleague, right? This is a student. This is someone he knows. But somehow, the story represents him as being anonymous, or at least unknown to Rebbe. How that is, I'm not sure. We have to figure that out together. That's one thing. Two is, interesting reality, Dachak, instead of saying Rabbi Yonatan ben Amram v'nichnas, some manuscripts leave out his title here and don't call him Rabbi, as if to represent him disguised already without the title Rabbi. Because he's going to claim later, as we're going to see, that he doesn't have any of this learning under his belt. But he does, and we know he does. An interesting feature of the literature. So, Dachak Rabbi Yonatan ben Amram v'nichnas, or it could say, Dachak Yonatan ben Amram v'nichnas. And he enters, and Rabbi Yonatan ben Amram says, Amar lo, Rabbi Yehuda he's talking to, Parnaseni, please, give me the food that I need. Sustain me. The word Parnasa?
Sustenance.
Could mean income as well, but in this case he's in the storage house with all the food, and what he means is, give me my allotment here. So now, you see the idiomatic piece already tells you, but in the Gemara it's not exactly so clear, but it becomes clear that Rebbe sets about to determine this person's eligibility for getting his portion. Now, by the way, we have, in certain cases, eligibility standards. So again, part of this discussion and this record could very well be, who controls storage houses for grain and food within communities? Sounds like Rebbe does. Sounds like the rabbis do. B, can they make the policy about who's eligible? What does that policy require of someone?
Yes.
C. How do I do an intake? What does intake look like? What are the questions I need to ask the person in terms of their getting any food from this food pantry? So now it happens. He says, Amar lo b'ni. Kirita? He says, my son, come forward. Have you learned any chumash? Amar lo. He says to him, lov, I have not. Rebbe inquires further. Shanita, as in Mishnah, when you are vishinantam, v'dibartabam, you're saying Mishnayot, you're learning out loud. Have you learned Mishnah? No. Amarle, love. Im kein b'ma'afarnescha, if that's so that you've not learned any of this, then on what merit, on why should I sustain you? You're not qualified here. You don't qualify for this program. Now, Yonatan ben Ahram does not reveal himself. And he says, Amar le, he says to him, Parnaseini kekelev v'chaorev, sustain me as you would a dog or a raven. What comes to mind immediately about a dog or a raven?
I got you. I don't know.
these are not precious animals. These are less precious animals.
They're not so precious. They're not so precious. You ever been near a raven?
Yeah.
It's like an insult.
It's like, right, Edgar Allan Poe comes to mind, right?
By the way, the very smart animal, the raven.
No, it is, very except smart. That if you've ever been by one.
Very intelligent animal.
I mean,
they're frightened.
They are so frightened. Beak is mean looking, and the
sound.
Oh, the sound, and and they look like they're going to attack you.
They know what they think of dogs in
the Torah. Yeah.
That's right, and we know what they think of dogs, though there is some positive stuff about it, but we'll get into that another time. But the dog, according to tradition, at that point, the dog in the ancient world, what does the dog do? It goes out with you and helps you
shepherd,
right? Does the dog eat food every day? No.
Yeah.
And they realize that the dog, it needs to by us, because, you know, dogs like us, we need to eat. But according to tradition, the dog could go, and this is somewhat medically right, there's a guy named Felix who does work in botany of the Torah and all the kind of research about animals in the Torah, that for 3 days certain species could go without a lot of food. They, of course, need to drink, need some kind of drink. But they have a slow processing of certain species have a way of keeping certain foods and drawing from foods over the course of 2.5-3 days. So he says, like a dog or a raven, and for a raven, all kinds of things in the world for a raven to eat that God provides for these lowly creatures. And so if God provides for those lowly creatures, you can't see through providing for a simple guy like me? Rebbe, what did he do? Parnasay. He gives in. He gives him the food. Oh, now it could have ended there.
Yeah.
Could have been a nice... Could have been a really nice story. Could have put our trust in Rebbe and the whole rabbinic system. But what does he do? Batar denafek. After Rabbi Yochanan departed, Yativ Rabbi v'kam mitztayer, and Rabbi was so troubled. Oh, I broke my policy. I broke it. He's so distressed, and he says, "V'amar oily shenatati piti v'amar aretz." How could I do this? Give such a my bread piti to this amar aretz. To this unlearned soul, to this simpleton, we wouldn't necessarily desire to hear that from Rebbe. Yeah. Right? We've said in different ways around the table already, Carol, in case you were starting to get disappointed in Rebbe. that we've been disappointed a little bit in some of what we are hearing from the rabbis separating themselves out from having to pay the taxes towards the public works or being involved in the tzedakah or here, Rebbe, but here's the saving grace, right? And this could be, and I'm asking you if you agree, this could be the moment that the whole before this and what we're going to learn after this hinges on this very moment. Which moment does it really hinge on? It might hinge on this moment. Listen to what happens. So, Amar lefanav Rabbi Shimon bar Rabbi. Rabbi Shimon bar Rabbi said before Rabbi. Who is that, by the way? His son.
Yes.
So he's bar Rabbi. He says, Abba. Shema Yonatan ben Amram, tell me dechahu. Perhaps that was Yonatan ben Amram, your student. Didn't you recognize him? But it may not be the total redemption that you're looking for, because, maybe it's because it was his student that he's going to feel better in a second. Listen, She'eno rotze le'anot mikavod Torah mi'amav. He wanted no honor afforded to him for his Torah learning. So this might say something really sweet about what Torah learning is supposed to get you in life. That I can't say to Rebbe, listen, I've learned Torah, Mishnah, Gemara, Halacha, I know Midrash, give me the food. Yeah. You're supposed to get no honor. Take no honor according to this student, Yonatan ben Amram. Badkuva Ashkach. And in fact, I'll get you. In fact, they investigate the matter, and it's discovered that in fact it was him. And then, realizing that other humble scholars might follow along those lines, is the way that the idiomatic translation works. Amar Rebbe, Yikansu Akol, let everybody then come. Two potential reads for what the story does and what the moment is. If his son is the person to come and say, listen, it could have all tied up nicely when you ultimately gave in and you gave him the food because he personally came, and even though he had nothing, he so demanded of you the justice due in the world and you gave it to him. Why are you troubled by that? And if he was thinking, well, I won't have enough for everybody who's deserving if that's the way it works. Everybody who comes going to ask me. And the first 100 people who push their way in, Dachak Yonatan ben Amram, if they push their way in and they demand it from me, I'll have nothing. And then this whole system will be broken. And that's why I'm troubled. And can't we build a system that works so we don't have to have people pushing their way in, disguising themselves, pleading their cases? You could really make of this a real good read into systematizing for the benefit of those who are hungry, the father and the son working out what the frustrations are, the disappointments. Of course, what it comes back to is that this guy didn't want to benefit from Torah, and he says about Torah, I can't take it because I've learned anything. And then instead of the idiomatic translation, though, after the discussion that nobody should benefit from Torah, we could even read stronger towards the positive and say, no. Read it like this. Torah never gets you the benefit of actually getting the food first. It's never about your own circle. You can't claim any greatness from Torah vis-a-vis these conversations that are parts of the minutes where everybody thinks the rabbi should be exempt from everything. No. The rabbis are required. What are they really required? The generosity of administering the soup kitchens, the grain storage houses, the food facilities, and the tzedakah kuppah, the funds that they have. And they have to do it not only for their own circles, but they got to do it for everybody. He opens to everyone because he realizes what's the really big generous read? Everybody has Torah. Everybody has a Torah. Everybody himself, herself, has a Torah in the world. A teaching to give, to create, to give over, to share. Everybody is a ben chachamim. if they're not a chacham themselves. Everybody is the child of the sages, just like they are in our theological parlance, a ben Adonai, a bat Hashem, a child, a divine, a child of the divine, a bar bat mitzvah. I could see everybody like that. If I was reading entirely generously and didn't see the classism within the pages of these Talmudic discussions, or I read this one piece against the grain of all those classist kind of texts, I could really push that reading and say, that's how we have to see this story. I want to say that because I do think at the core of these pages of Gemara, Rebbe and the rabbis are trying to get to a place of recognizing every individual has needs and every individual needs to be seen as individually worthy, and it doesn't really matter if you are part of the rabbinic class or not. But the next part of the Gemara is not going to let me do that so easily.
So far we've heard about crony tzedakah.
This
is crony tzedakah. It's pretty obvious, right?
But
there's no need to
say
everybody's got Torah. Everybody was made in God's image, whether or not they've got Torah or not. And that should be enough for the Rebbe.
Sounds like an elitist to me.
What Max Kedushin would say to you, Barry, I think if I could speak for the great Dr. Kedushin, is that the value concept here of Torah lechulam, if you're going to read generously like I read, versus generously like you're reading, and that is that there needed to be a aval kulam betzelem Elohim. But everybody's written in God's image. It doesn't matter whether you have Torah or not. That was an alternative value concept that could have very well come here, and that if you're reading with that value concept in mind, by the way, because you really have taken that to heart, and you insert that into the conversation here, Max Kedushin would say that's you've become a Gemara reader.
Okay. Well, I mean, it just seems pretty straightforward to me. This is not a hard...
Not to everyone. That's the problem with... I mean, that's the problem with the credits Bobby's talking about in modern law, and that's the problem with our notion of tzedakah and how people give it or they don't give it in our world.
This is exactly the issue of universal health care.
Right. It could very well be.
It starts off by saying there's a famine. If there's a famine, there's a possibility that people are going to die. And the rabbi could be looking at perpetuating Judaism by having those who survive be knowledgeable.
So David, you're doing a wonderful foreshadowing for us.
That's what you need to do if you want the future.
Yeah. David, you're doing a wonderful foreshadowing for us.
Yeah.
We'll remember your comment that there's possibly death at hand. That the stakes are very high. And that's going to manifest itself in Talmudic argumentation a little bit down the line in these pages, and the way they're going to talk about it is through how we ultimately have to administer tzedakah funds, but they're going to get to such a level the same as you're getting now, so hold off, because we're not going to allow ourselves in the weeks that we're going to give ourselves to study this before we turn on to other subject matter to let that escape us. That's going to be essential and central.
So we have a very basic sentence in Judaism, in En Kemach, En Torah.
Nice. So that's
and
what we call...
it looks like Rabbi Yudana didn't know this.
Translate.
If there is no powder, there is no Torah.
There's no flour.
If there is no flour, there is no Torah. It's a basic concept of our tradition.
He reversed it. He said
if you eat it, there's sustenance. Exactly. If you are hungry, you'll never learn. That's the reason we feed our children in school. So that's a basic concept in our tradition.
What Ron is bringing forward is a text that's in Pirkei Avot. It's a late part of the Mishnah. It's pretty much accepted that tradition was created around the 6th, 7th, or even as late as the 8th century. And what I went to point out, and I was going to, with that being the intertext we use, what Ron brought forward, this text that seems to very much relate to the value orientation of our Gemara, and that's called intertextuality. Right? That may be a term that's familiar or not familiar, but in terms of the way we read one text and another very much together, that relate to one another, not just kind of, oh, same word mentioned here. That text, indeed, might be the outcome of deliberations that happen here. And it's said in both ways, in Avot. Im ein kemach ein Torah, im ein Torah ein kemach. If there's no Torah, then there's no food to eat, and if there's no food to eat, there's no Torah. Kind of giving a certain sense that, what is the, if there's no Torah, there's no kemach. Obviously, it's not holding by this value, that if you don't learn something, right. But how does it manifest itself? They take Rebbe's stubbornness, and they say, ah, here's what we really mean by that. If there's no Torah, meaning pursuit of justice, vis-a-vis the society, poor and wealthy alike, everyone's going to go hungry. So they expand the notion of what Torah is there. Most Mefarshim, actually, most commentators expand that notion. And they don't say it's about the requirement of, you know, on the intake form, whether you've learned anything. It's about whether or not society has decided that there will be a just and equitable way of getting everybody food in a time of drought and famine, especially. So that Mishnah does stand to represent some of the value orientation that ultimately came out of the deliberations here.
Just wondering, is he old, Rebbe, at this point? Is it possible that he doesn't have good eyesight, or that?
Oh, on the not recognizing. Yeah.
Or is it possible that it's been a long time? I mean, you can be a student, a disciple, that goes off and has aged and grown over the years, and he comes back and he doesn't recognize him. I mean, he could have also tried to,
Could have processed that too.
No, it's like the story of Yosef and Nechama.
Maybe that's why he needs his son.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why he needs his son to come really help him administer.
But his son is better at recognizing him after a while. But, I mean...
Those are really nice reads.
Yeah, but I do think that in this instance, what makes the difference for him, he really gives preferential treatment to learned people because they investigated the matter and found that this... Oh, great. So he was afraid that he might refuse help or they may not seek help altogether. So I think that his motives are to really protect the learned rather than to expand this for everybody.
I think these were in circles, you know. These were his own tribe, so to speak.
Right. And that's why I think the question of his son is it's kind of essential to the story if the story is going to help him get past his own sensibility that he only wants to protect the inner circle. Because what if it is Yonatan ben Amram, right? And he's kind of cracking Rebbe in that way, saying, you've got to really reevaluate, like even the poor
deserve the food.
Deserve the food, because look, that guy is kind of like your disciple.
It was a little
now, it was found out that he was the disciple, but in the generous read of the text, Rebbe might say, oh, even every poor person has a face and a name. Now, I told you that my teacher, Rabbi Dr. Aryeh Cohen, was writing about this sugya in the Journal of Religious Ethics. He just published this. This is what he said, Bobby, about the disguise. I think we should write him with some of your potential understandings of how the disguise works. If anybody else has an idea about the disguise, this is what he wrote in the article. One is led to wonder how he disguised himself. Perhaps in the surprising answers to the rote questions, his actual identity was veiled. Perhaps in just this act of denying his knowledge, his identity actually changed. At least vis-a-vis Rebbe. Like he just couldn't recognize him. All the other possibilities are there as well. But this gets
someone who's not very visual. Maybe Rebbe wasn't very visual because he should be able to.
Well, but also his behavior was not the behavior of a rabbi.
I think he was a troubled kid.
By acting like a boar, he may be more difficult to recognize him.
I like the notion. I mean, it's a little Occam's razor. We're making up a lot of facts about time and details and things like that. But if he wasn't really there in Rebbe's circle and he heard this was the policy and he comes barreling in and he's the quote-unquote rabbi activist,
Right. I think he's a troubled rabbi. He wanted to make a point.
I think that that kind of goes along, though that's not written in this article. It does kind of go along with Aryeh's main points about what he thinks rabbinic culture should be about anyhow. So he might have even intimated that here in the article, but I think we can see in his action a certain willingness to speak up, to stand up,
dachak,
to... Right, dachak. And, right, exactly. It gets from the verb
point.
Dachak. And that, ultimately, if you want to bring up another textual tradition, what is the verb dachak? Sometimes, how does that manifest in the Gemara? It manifests in the notion that we have sometimes what's called a sha'at hadachak. Right? A time of emergency. A time that you need
sha'at
to...
Dachak.
Well, you have both. And at that time, at that very hour, and the reason it's ha is because you have a specific moment where you have to act.
Emergency.
In a way that halachically you might have thought was totally against the grain of our tradition. But you've got to act because there's something at stake. In this case, what's at stake? Life's at stake. And that's, again, going to be manifested later. So, I'm not sure exactly what to make of the minutes of all these meetings about the rabbis only wanting to make sure that they've got their own circles taken care of. But it does go further, and someone recorded it, and even though it's kind of surprising, and even though it's kind of shocking, and even though we have to ask ourselves, well, why is this? I mean, they even want to make the point after the story, which they didn't have to do. They didn't have to, and obviously they don't see it as necessarily so negative either, because someone in the next piece really says, that's Rabbi Shita. Come on, you have to realize, that's Rabbi Shita. Look, Rabbi Litame, this is Rabbi going according to his own opinion. The Amar Rabbi, for Rabbi said, Ein poranut balo lam ela bishvil amei aretz. Misfortune comes only when you have people who are not really getting into rabbinic culture. Now, is this the way that the rabbis are trying to say, you really got to buy into what we're doing here, guys? You really got to buy into the project? Here's how it worked. There's a story that comes along to illustrate. Kahahu demeklilid shadu atveria. It is like the case of the tax to raise money for a crown that was imposed on the inhabitants of Tveria. Now, the ruler had allowed us to rebuild Tveria with Chachamim. It became, again, in circulation. The Chachamim are back. It's one of the great cities near the Sea of Galilee. This was a time that rabbinic culture is really being revived there. Rebbe exempts the rabbis of the town from the tax. Atu lekame de Rebbe, the unlearned townsfolk come before Rebbe. V'amrulei leitzvu rabbanan bahadan. He says, let the rabbis contribute along with us. And Rebbe says, Amar lehu lo. He says, no way, we're not paying the tax. And amrulei, and they say to him, Arukinan, we'll flee the city. We can't bear that tax burden ourselves. This whole place is filled with chachamim. You guys are here, you need to pay the tax, the crown tax. Rebbe didn't oppose that idea, though. Oh, here's what he says. Aruku! Sofli! Go ahead.
Hey, one.
Leave. Leave Tveria. Arku palgehon. Suddenly, half of them fled. Deluya palga.
Going to Florida.
When they get... Oh, so that's what I'm saying. Maybe some cities are only going to be cities of Chachamim, and maybe they want some cities.
They move
to
Tzfat.
Yeah, well, and then the Tzfat rabbis have to do the same thing, because that's one of the holy
cities.
That's
what they did right now there. They want
that's
to
right.
Everybody
that's right. I mean, that's one of the things I was going to mention is this is happening today in Israel.
It's happening in the United States.
It's happening in the United States. That's right.
From state to state.
All you need to look at is also by us, the whole situation in Rockland County.
Everywhere. This is universal.
I don't know what is the situation in Rockland County.
No, just that it's very Hasidic and very religious and full of the Chachamim and their children. And when it comes to paying taxes, they're not participating in the same way that other Jewish communities participate in taxation. And they're receiving some benefits when it comes to health and medical care. I mean, these are all big questions about how a community ultimately creates policies, creates colleges, creates vocational schools or not, right?
Has a fire department.
Or right, and has not only a fire department, but how they afford the local hospital that is under their own auspices. And just amazing amounts of questions about fiscal policy that grow out of all these questions, right? But Rebbe here, you know, saw them go, and they say, oi, and atu hanhu palga kame Rebbe, the remaining half of the population comes before Rebbe, amarle, they say to him, late for Rabbanan Bahadam, they say, you know, come on, rabbis, you've got to contribute with us. Now the only half of us are here, and they still want the tax. Amarlehu lo. He says to them, no way. We can't let the rabbis participate. Arukinan, we also got to go then. If you can't, Aroku, flee. So Arku, kulhu. All of them go. And all the townspeople go. Pashahu Kovis, however, a certain launderer remained in town. Shadyuhu Akovis, thereupon the imperial governors imposed the entire remaining tax on the launderer. Arakovis, even the launderer pled.
So who's laundry?
Right. So he's obviously
he's
the rabbi's personal cleaner.
Well, there was no money. Couldn't launder money.
That's right. Paka Klila, and the tax for the crown was canceled. But here's the thing. Paka Klila, and the tax of the crown was canceled, even though the rabbis were still residing in Tveria. Amar Rebbe. So Rebbe says, here's his shita. Ra'itim she'ein poranud ba'al olam ela bishvil amei ha'aretz. You see, taxation and the oppression of the governments that we have to suffer only comes through those who are unlearned. If they weren't here in the first place, we would have never had the tax.
Wasn't he a wealthy man, Rebbe?
He had a fortune.
Wasn't the Rebbe
a wealthy man? He was very wealthy.
So they say. It would be one thing if he was protecting an entire class of people who had literally nothing. But we know some of them had some wealth. But why would the Gemara, the rabbi's own Talmud, include the minutes of these meetings? Why would they give us, you know, all those beautiful values, Tzelem Elohim, creating God's image, and we know this is life or death, and we're going to get to places where tzedakah is discussed, and the importance of having a soup kitchen and a tzedakah fund, and all this, and it's going to come like right on the heels of this. So now, like, this is like the crescendo of these passages, and we're going to move into the tzedakah stuff the next time we meet. Why would they do this? Why would the self-critical analysis of their own circles be included, and so strongly, with Rebbe, the editor and compiler of the Mishnah, even. So let's talk about why they would do this.
Can you just say something about this crown? I read the note that says that it was for a Roman emperor.
Right.
So no, but that was probably building Tveria.
Tveria becomes a city that's granted in a certain way towards the Chachamim ask for it, and amidst the buildup of society post the time that they decided absolutely no pursuit of the Third Temple, and all of the military rebellion is down, right? And the Mishnah has come about, and the rabbis, Rebbe particularly, really sense that there's going to be now rabbinic culture, that we can move out of Tzipori, and the Sanhedrin that was on the move, we can have now our own kind of place in Tveria that will become also a center of learning. And that's, what do they need? They need a crown tax. They have to say to the emperor, thank you.
Right, so, I mean, Tveria was really integrated into Rome accommodatingly. So I don't know if there's a political dimension to this, that they get the Romans to not...
For sure the rabbis are becoming the socio-political leaders in addition to religious leaders,
right,
of that time, and it's post the kind of putting down all the potential military rebellion, and it's the dedication they have to the crown. But, again, the rabbis being this kind of culture of, if in some way you could say, to anywhere from privilege to status afforded them as leadership with diplomatic immunity to all kinds of things like this, they are trying to find their own way into being able to create the leadership cadre they need. And every leadership cadre, we know this from history, right, has a certain way of how are we going to amass wealth, keep wealth, and really create the system whereby our own people may listen to us, or some of us will become the ambassadors to the state. So if there's that dimension of ambassadorship to the state in whatever way that's going on here, Rebbe is concerned that the rabbis have that place of prominence, that are afforded a certain status and place in society. And right here in Tveria, as a seat of some of that power in the north, he may not really care whether or not the general population, general Jewish population, hangs around, according to this story.
But do the rabbis live happily ever after?
Well, we could say that we are rabbinic Jews in whatever way.
So the activism of the unlearned had a benefit.
Yeah, I mean, and the activism of the rabbis themselves to write themselves into history this way has some benefit. Nonetheless,
and the tax was rescinded.
This may be, now let's read it a different way. This may be, in the end, overstated and exaggerated.
It's hard to believe that they would cancel the tax.
Right. Yeah. This right. may right. indeed be overstated and exaggerated.
For the purpose of?
For the purpose of saying, if you have your system where you're only providing for one another and putting yourselves outside the crown tax and participating with the people, look what's going to happen. You're going to be uprooted from the land. You're going to be uprooted from every city you thought you had a safe place in. It could be an inner critique of the end game of their corrupt or selfish policy.
Yes, it's sort of what I was thinking of, that it's, well, it highlights the perils of being powerful and being able to select the, you know, being able to make big decisions about the well-being or the very life of other people, and how it's fraught with the risks of making big mistakes, and then you try and reverse your mistake and unintended consequences and all of those kinds of things. When you are the leader.
Yeah. And can you reverse? And so, like, in a certain way, the shift here, this was like you blew the tire. Let's change the flat and let's get some other policy on the books that works better for us. That's where it's going to go. So I think the reverse or shift into a different gear may, in fact, from this point be evidenced in some of what we're about to read in pages to come.
And I also see it as a metaphor for your gentrification phenomenon. On a certain level.
Nice.
Don't the rabbis think that they have prevailed because the tax for the crown was canceled and the rabbis still reside in Tiberias?
Yeah. I'm not sure that
fortune comes to the world only because of the unlearned
yeah.
people. I don't know whether the rabbis are seeing that this is their fault.
Yeah. I'm not sure that it's quote unquote a real story, or it's just this exaggeration of what might happen, and it's in like dreamland.
It's hard to know when they're ironic
yeah.
and when they're not.
Yeah, it's difficult.
It's kind of difficult.
You see that misfortune comes to the world only because of unlearned people. Reminds me of what some of the rabbis said about Holocaust victims, about blaming themselves, and, you know, about that
yeah. terrible. So if we read that the rabbis feel victorious, and if we read that the rabbis are blaming these people, right, and they could care less if they were in town, then it's true. Like, you could probably find examples of that throughout history. On the other hand, sometimes in terms of self-critique, and it is difficult to understand when they're being harsh on themselves, ironic, or self-critical to the point that I'm going to suggest right now. So take this with, you know, the reading against the grain. I think the rabbis might be calling themselves Am Haaretz here in a very veiled way. Now, that's a very on-its-head kind of reading. Because how could Rebbe, who set up the Mishnah, who we learned the Mishnah last time. Remember, we took the Mishnah out from Peah, and we saw that, you know, they were moving towards taking care of people in the polis, in the cityscape, in the urban venture. How could this be the answer? So to me, I'm sensing that this is a moment of deep irony, that this is a self-critique. We're going to get into policy about how you administer a kupa, a fund, a soup kitchen soon. We're going to talk about the urgency of getting those funds into people's hands. the big stakes here, and we're moving into that. We have a week of learning next week together. We're going to get into some of that text. The 21st before Hanukkah, Dr. Rabbi Mordechai Schwartz is coming back to do one of the Talmudic takes pieces. He's a professor from a seminary, a dear friend, and we'll take a couple weeks break after that, learn a couple more weeks of tzedakah. So those shiurim to come. Great to see a big midrash filled tonight.
Thank you.